Welcome to Unlimited Realities. I'm your host, Lisa Zimmer, and today I'm so honored to bring you such a special guest for all the wisdom and all the truth that she's going to give us today. We are so honored to have the wonderful Jean Houston in our presence, in our audience today. She's going to be gifting us with her wisdom. Jean is a visionary, pioneer, and teacher who has worked with UNICEF, the United Nations, NASA, and many others, as well as written over 26 books. She has also written this wonderful, incredible book, The Wizard of Us, in which she has just received the Novelist Silver Award. And Jean, thank you so much for being our guest today. God bless you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Lisa, for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. I've been very much looking forward to this, and I absolutely loved your book. So without further ado, I'm going to just jump right in because there's so much that we could cover in this book. It's just a chock full of insight and power, and it really empowers the reader. So throughout the book, as we all know, the story of the Wizard of Oz, and this is the Wizard of Us, it's covered with a tremendous amount of instances where courage is used. And mm-hmm. as we open up in the beginning of the book, we talk about Dorothy, who is devastated by a tornado, and it destroyed her home, and she got bumped on the head and fell into her bed. But before we travel down Dorothy's adventure, we look at Dorothy, and she has the wherewithal to scoop up her dog Toto and travel away from the tornado and the destructed house. Now, the courage that little girl had at that point was pretty phenomenal, but how would that look if she had a lack of courage or a lack of optimism in going forward in her path?
She would have had a very dull life of living the same old, same old. She would have been an encapsulated bag of skin dragging around a dreary little ego, and there would be no book. And there'd be no wizard and no adventure and no Glinda and no Tin Man and none of the great disenfranchised parts of herself that then became abundant and real, like the Scarecrow and his extraordinary mind and the Tin Man and their deep empathy and, of course, the Lion with his immense courage. And there would be no journey.
And there would be no witch, and there would be no horror, and no obstacles mm-hmm. to overcome. But as she was traveling down her path, and she encountered Glinda, and Glinda actually came in as her IntelliKey. Can we talk a little bit about what an IntelliKey is and how mm-hmm. Dorothy embodied that with Glinda?
Well, IntelliKey is an ancient Greek word used by Aristotle. And the way Aristotle described it is the IntelliKey of an acorn to be an oak tree. So it's the deep, purposeful thing that is always engendered in us for our next becoming. It's the IntelliKey of winter to turn into spring. It's the IntelliKey of spring to find its fruiting in summer. It's the IntelliKey of a baby to be a grown-up human being. It's the IntelliKey of a popcorn kernel to be a fully popped entity. But it's the IntelliKey of each one of us to be so much, much more than we ever thought we could be. But it took a certain kind of crisis, consciousness, a planetary civilization, which we are headed toward, and the enormous changes, the accelerated rate of change of our time, the tornadoes that we all live in constantly, it seems, to mm-hmm. be able to bring about this risk, this willingness to leave the living in an outmoded situation and get on with it. I think I told you before we began, Lisa, that yesterday I was in Boston.
Yes.
And I wasn't, because I was just on the way from Cape Cod to my where I was teaching to the airport, and I saw the smoke, and I heard the devastation. I mean, I wasn't there for it, but I saw it. And there you saw such heroic actions, you know. You saw people who, you know, just picked themselves up and ran over and put on tourniquets and helped people and never gave up. When they finally got home, they were shaking like mad, but
right.
while
right.
there, you know. And interesting, the people who ran away tended to run into the smoke. You know, that's one of the things that was reported on the news today. But it's amazing how we all have this great, what should we say it, this really great energy of courage and creativity when the going gets rough. We have within us levels and levels of skill, of courage, of heart, of mind. And the point of my little book there was to really show people how to develop these kinds of things, because the book itself is iconic. It really is the tale of both personal and social transformation.
Right. And you also have such great analogies throughout it. And what I really, really appreciated was you didn't leave the reader hanging. You offered so many incredible tools to really move through and absorb and the awareness and to evolve through it. And you, the one piece that I really loved and I really appreciated was you included a chapter on sharpening our senses. And I loved that you included this because as simple as it is, it's so paramount to increasing our awareness. Can we talk a little bit about the ease of just simply sharpening our senses? Because that's something that, you know, the audience could do as soon as we hang
surely,
on.
Yes. Sure. Well, why don't we do, you and I do a little exercise on that back and forth.
Okay.
Okay? All right.
Sure.
Now, are you sitting in your home? Are you sitting, can you look out the window and see things?
I am totally focused on you, and I am sitting upright in my chair in my room here.
Okay. But you do have a window there.
I do.
And if you look out the window, what do you see?
It is my backyard and my pool and green grass and beautiful oak trees and a creek. It's a canal, but it's a small canal.
Sounds like Oz to me.
It's gorgeous. I'm very blessed here.
Right. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to challenge you to think about something, and then you're going to challenge me. Let's start with touch. I want you to touch the long, bony nose of a horse. And when you feel that, then you give me a touch. You say, Jean, I want you to touch.
Okay.
So you say, Jean, I want you to touch. And
Jean, I want you to touch the tail of a German Shepherd.
Who's sitting right by me, by the way.
I have one, too.
All right, Lisa, I want you to plunge your hands into a barrel of potato chips and break up as many as you can.
And, Jean, I'd like you to touch a bowl of ice cubes.
Okay. Now, you see, this is what we would do. We would go back and forth.
Okay.
And you would be developing the internal part of touch. Now, if we then move to, say, taste, I would say, Lisa, I want you to taste hot buttered corn.
Mm.
And you then would say, Jean, whatever.
Jean, I want you to taste honey.
Ah, yes. Lisa, I'd like you to taste an angel food cake topped with minted dark chocolate mousse and whipped cream.
Oh. Now I'm going to have to make it when we get off.
You see, this is what we do. We go back and forth, and the people can do this with their children or with their friends. You go back and forth maybe 5 or 6 times with each sense, and you challenge. And it's one of the best ways of developing inner sensory imagery. Now, if we kept at this, and I had you then look out, you know, out of your window right now, has anything shifted in what you're seeing, in the grass, in the oak trees?
Nothing has shifted physically, but I can feel more.
You feel more.
I feel more. I can feel the environment more. I can feel the warmth of the air. I can, you know, before I was looking out,
exactly.
It was beautiful, and it was just visual. Now I'm more in tune with the feeling aspect.
So just a little bit of that exercise, because the whole exercise, you know, which I indicate in the book, is one in which, using actually Oz as an example, but what it does is it activates the interior senses. When you activate the interior senses, this activates sensory intelligence and sensory acuity and creativity. I once made a study of 55 of some of the most creative people in North America among my research subjects, meaning they came to my house or I was at their house and I studied the way they was for 20 years, Joseph Campbell, 6 years with Margaret Mead, who lived with us the last 6 years of her life, off and on.
Those are incredible geniuses.
Buckminster Fuller. And
wow.
A lot of people whose names that you would not know, but who had high, high sensory acuity, both inner and outer. And it was because of this that they could drop an idea into their minds and it would just constellate. It would grow. It was like a seed crystal in a supersaturated solution. And the creative ideas would then pour out. Because creativity is right next to the internal imagery of the mind, you see. I have found in my studies of thousands of people that beneath the surface crust of consciousness, the creative ideal is going on all the time. So in the metaphor of going to Oz, and by the way, in the book written in 1900, Frank Baum had it was a real tornado that lifted up a real house. It wasn't a bonk on the head that they put in the 1939 movie. I mean, suggesting,
okay.
Yeah, these are in some sense real places within ourselves, all the parallel worlds within us, if you will, all the treasures of mystery and imagination that then well up when we pay attention to them to give us, you know, the unexpected, unobstructed universe, give us access to our immense powers of creativity and solution and problem finding, as well as a different mood. I mean, one of the things that happens in that marvelous story is that everybody's mood lifts.
Yes.
You know, everybody is surprised by joy, stunned, evoked, ignited, and able to take on the great tasks of intelligence, of heartfulness, and of courage, and to take
right.
Go on the road of spiritual pollen, the yellow brick road.
And with that optimism that they do all seem to feed off of, because there's a group energy that they seem to build up to as they're gathering their group together. First it starts with Toto and Dorothy, and then she comes down the road and she meets the scarecrow, who feels stuck in a failure because he can't scare the birds. And when she walks by and asks directions and he says either way is fine, he's showing his optimism and he's showing his adaptability. But he also laments about wanting a brain. So in that mm-hmm. moment of realization and expanded awareness that she's getting him to go down to see the wizard with her, he finds his potency in his imagination, and he begins to dance. Let's talk about that self-awareness and how that can be termed contemplative neuroscience.
All right. Well, for example, I once met Ray Bolger, who played, you know, the scarecrow. And
okay.
I lived in New York for many years, and I was walking down Broadway, and there he was. He had just gotten out of some show he was in. I think it was Where's Charlie? And I greeted him and thanked him and said he said for his wonderful dancing and singing. So he linked arms with me and we just went dancing down Broadway. You know, that is how remarkably spontaneous and full of fun he was. But so the point, I think, is that he was embodied grace and intelligence, the actor himself, you know. And the same was true in another way of Bert Lahr, you know. But the fact is, when we use our minds in different ways, when we think in images as well as in words, when we think with our whole bodies, kinesthetically, when we think musically, when we really pay attention to the incredible richness that we contain, when we become archaeologists of our own mind and spelunkers in the caves of our own creativity, our intelligence grows. Our brains are being reformed. This whole field, fairly recent, of neuroplasticity, meaning the way the brain can rearrange itself, can restructure itself, can heal itself. We now know that the brain is tremendously malleable. And what I try to do in this book, you know, especially when I take up the subject of the scarecrow, is show how one can actually actualize these different forms of intelligence. Because, as I said, you can learn to do so many things with the brain that was never really thought of before. But we're living in the time of the golden age of brain and mind research, which I and my husband, in a small way, you know, have also been part of, you know, over many, many years.
Right.
So, I've never met a stupid child. I've met incredibly stupid and dumb and diminishing forms of education. But
right.
If a child is learning hands-on, sensory, rich, you know, deeply involved in the whole process of learning. I mean, if you're going to learn how to do fractions, why not learn weaving at the same time? If you're going to learn about history, have dramatic forms of it, enact the history, you know. If you're going to learn mathematics, also study drumming and music. I mean, we find,
right.
for example, that in the schools where they have chorals, as for example in Hungary, they're way, way ahead of everybody else in Europe and America in mathematics. I mean, we know so
right.
much about the brain, but engaging the full body, the full mind of ourselves as adults and also as when we were children shows that we can really remake our minds, our brains.
So by using different aspects of our body, does it actually fire up neuropathways within our brain?
Oh,
is
yeah.
that what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's our body, it's our imagination, it's our relationships. Everything feeds the renewal of the brain. You know, we are in a time of renaissance, a renaissance of perspective, a renaissance of the relationship between women's roles in the world, probably the biggest change in human history, by the way.
Right.
But it is, truly. I mean, my claim to fame is I'm one of the best traveled people who's ever lived. You know, I've worked in 108 countries. And all over the world, I see things that are never reported in the press. And one of it is the rise of women to full partnership with men in the whole domain of human affairs, with some really dreadful backlash, there's no question of it, and confusion and frustration. But the fact is that with women rising, with the emphasis on process rather than on product, on making things cohere, develop, grow, on being storied, narrative, you know, as Dorothy is narrative and stories, compassion, going together in a team, you know, she's not the lonely hero just off by
right.
himself. All of this is shifting the story.
And it shifts with each character that she meets, because then we move into meeting the Tin Man, and
yes.
he wants a heart. And I loved your analogy here where you looked at this as the machinery replacing human beings in the turn of the century. So
mm-hmm.
as we look at this, we kind of see this kind of replaying itself out now, where you see less human contact face-to-face and more social interaction and more, you know, texting and tweeting and, you know, voicemails and things like this. Let's
yeah.
talk a little bit about how that Tin Man, in wanting a heart, actually found himself having a tremendous amount of compassion.
Well, you know, I know so many young people who have transcendental thumbs on their BlackBerrys. You know, and callous too. Sometimes I'm doing 5,000-6,000 texts a day. You know, I personally believe this is a phase. I'll have to tell you right now. I really
okay,
do.
Good.
You know, we get obsessed with the technology before we get bored with it. Being how many people really spend hours and hours and hours watching television?
True.
10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was a huge amount. That's not happening anymore. And,
good point.
Yeah, the television industry is in big trouble because people prefer to be on the computers, interacting, texting. We're about to have these watches through which you can really do all kinds of things. And whenever you have high tech, you almost always then have a follow-up of high touch. So
mm-hmm.
I think that Facebook will become face-face. I see this happening more and more and more. I find, for example, in the Facebook, so many people actually finding ways of meeting, of interacting, of doing things, of problem-solving together. And this is never talked about by the nerds who write about it. They're caught up
That's
in their little
true.
Tiny chambers, you know, with, you know, completely covered by screens. But I have to live at the edges so much. You know, as I told you, there I was in the whole
right.
tragedy of the Boston Marathon was going on, and I saw some of it. I'm like Foster Gump, you know, female version. And I seem to be present at the creation, present at situations happening. It's just where I am. It's just the way my life has gone. That's why I've met so many of these extraordinary people and have been so fortunate. But the thing is, having been present to history, there is something about seeing the phenomenal shifts in history in which we are really experiencing a renaissance in perspective. We now know that we no longer just live in the universe, but the universe lives in us. We have access through all my takings of depth soundings of the psyche of thousands of people over so many years. We are actually moving into a situation of an upheaval, of rising of the spirit, of rising of a collective and radically personal unique sensibility. I mean, this is the most interesting time in human history. Other times thought they were it, they're wrong. This is it. But how
right.
do we train ourselves for this time? A lot of leaders have been trained to be the equivalent of white males of the year 1926, have not been. The Wizard of Oz, like The Wizard of Oz, is a training movie, is a training form. It is to train us to live in the much larger reality that really requires our commitment, our love, our belief, and our action if we are going to survive this time. Otherwise, I would say that the human species is largely diminished within 200 years, if not sooner.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that gives us a lot of hope for humanity and compassion reigning again. We have, because we're dealing with a lot of the heart-centered universe, and we have a tremendous amount of people recognizing that coming from the heart, being truthful, coming from a compassionate self, coming from love, is really the authentic self. And as science has shown us, the heart communicates to the body, it communicates to
yes.
the brain, it communicates on so many different levels. How can we evolve through trusting our hearts, and how can we be more mindful in listening to it?
Well, part of it is just agreeing to listen to it.
Yeah.
But to listen with a certain... Remember that we are mind and heart and spirit. We are all these things. We are not one part separated from the other. So we can listen to the heart and feel its beating. All right, let me give you an exercise to do this. I don't think it's in the book. I would like you and everybody else who's listening in to think heartfully about somebody they know. And just send waves of heartful resonance, heartful acceptance, heartful joy, love to this other person. Okay? Everybody's
okay.
doing that now.
Yes.
And now in your heart, just imagine that your heart is asking them to send it, the same kind of heartful connection to two others. And then they to two others, and they to two others, they to the others, they to the others. And I would say within about 10 seconds, the whole world is connected, quite literally.
Wow.
Kind of algorithm of love. And then I want you to send a heartful connection to some creature, animal, cat, dog, whatever, horse. And in your heartful mind, because these are heartful beings, ask them to send to two others, and to two others, and to two others, and they to two others, and they to two others. And now all of sentient creation is connected. And now I ask you to send from our planet to two other planets, because we take it that the planets are living, and they to two others, two others, two others, two others. And now all the planets of our galaxy are connected. And now to our sun. And to the sun, suns, and they to two others, two others. And now the 100 billion plus stars in our galaxy are connected. And now from our galaxy to the galaxies of galaxies and to two others and two others, until finally our whole universe, which could be composed, by the way, of as many as a trillion galaxies, and from our universe to the mind and heart of all being, whatever you want to call it, God, the cosmos being that is mindful and loving. And so from your heart to the mind of all being, the heart of all being, the life of all being, the cosmos, the universe, filled with this incredible love, and from that loving being that is the universe, that is the God, that is the great creation, creator, back to you, and from you and your heart to the God, and from God back to you, so that you are in this constant bum-bum, 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 where it all becomes a great rhythm of love. Everything connected.
Wow. That was powerful. I felt quite a surge there. Okay. Now I have to gain composure and get back into the question.
We don't fool around here.
No, we don't. We don't mess around at all here. That was great, Jean. I could visualize the energy going out as I was sending the love out and watching that love from that person go out and do the universe into the planets. It was quite incredible. Now, getting back into our human world here, we have
that
a
is
lot.
Our human world.
Our human world is going through such a shift and change, and such an awakening,
yes,
and awareness and sensitivity. And everywhere you look, everybody's searching and seeking and looking outside of themselves and trying to connect on a deeper energetic spiritual aspect within themselves and with God, or what, like you said, cosmos, whatever term you want to give it. Why, when we have this shift that's going on right now, that there's such a delineating factor between those who are seeking and those who are still kind of stuck in a materialism, and not really listening to their inner heart of supporting humanity, and find themselves constantly thirsty for more and more things to fill up that void within. Would you call this a timed poverty?
Well, there is definitely an impoverishment of the heart, isn't there? And
yeah,
there's various historical reasons for it, too. I mean, one of the main reasons being that until the 19th century, most people lived pretty much the way they had for the previous 5,000 years, with just enough or not enough, you know, to keep their metabolism going. And then
right,
in the 19th century came all these changes and the Industrial Revolution, and people moved to the cities, and suddenly the things of matter, the mattering, multiplied. There was so much more to buy, to wish, to want, to use, and so that, and so the instead of it being family centered or village centered, it became other centered. The object became without, and it was people knew themselves by the things that they could materialize, and that then led to the vast, you know, despair and frustration in their own humanity, because they had lost. They had become autistic with regard to nature and themselves, and separated. And in this great divide, they also began to lose their sense of play, of playfulness, of the comic that is at the heart of all creation, and above all, of the love that moves the sun and all the stars. And that, of course, then reverberated, and thus more and more people, especially because of the rise of women, you know, to full partnership.
Right.
This is shifting everything. We have crossed the great divide of otherness. We are reaching out to each other. We are exploring our interior places, and the exploration of the interior places is giving us the fact of what is Oz in us, what is the wizard in us. So the point of my book and of the seminar I'm about to give in your part of the country, yes, next week.
Oh, where are you coming?
Where do you live?
I live in Florida, in Vero Beach on the East Coast.
Oh, that's right. Okay, yeah. No, I'm around all over the place. I thought I was also near there. No, but what this does, my friend, is it gives us the capacities to probe, to grow, to be, to explore, to become. We are the ones who are at the cutting edge of history, of which there is an incredible before and after of which that is almost mythic in scope.
Amen. It's coming at a time that we're feeling it in such waves and quickness and almost like a quickening. How can social artistry guide us here with this?
Well, social artistry is a term that I essentially invented some years ago, quite a few years ago, actually. And it really means that the canvas of the social artist is society. Just like a fine artist has their canvas with paints or their clay or their music, but in this case it is society. And so what I've been doing is training a great many people around the world in social artistry, in really being able to bring those passionate skills of being able to really get themselves into the real spirit and the authentic power of different cultures, of being able to use these different human development tools to expand their awareness, their senses, their own, the enormous, marvelous forms, many forms of their own psychology, so they are not, as I said, these encapsulated bags of skin with a little ego, but the fact that we have many, many more parts of themselves. So working with the UN and other international agencies, I go into places where there are very real troubles, and we work from inside out to expand the human capacity that then is able to look at the social problems in much, much more coherent and beautiful and artistic ways, you see.
That's incredible. It must be life-changing for those who are working with you in the social artistry. I mean, it must change their whole perspective.
People think so.
Because it comes from a place of, you know, because you work with a lot of youth, too, don't you? Did you bring a lot of...
I work literally with people at all ages.
On all ages. Okay. So, say they had...
People in their 90s, you know.
Oh, wow. That's a big, wide realm of people there. Do you find that as they walk out of their comfortable existence and they're in a place that they're kind of in a little bit of a culture shock, do you see like the aha moments? Do you see that awakening come across their face? Do you see that, you know, that shine that they feel that they're fulfilling something by being there?
Yes, 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 and they want more, more, more. Which is why people go to my website, they'll find opportunities for this sort of thing. JeanHouston.com. You know,
JeanHouston.com, yes. We're going to definitely put that in there, too.
Yeah.
Now, we're going through a period of the scarecrow.
You're breaking up a little bit. You're breaking up a little bit. So.
Okay, can you hear me now?
No. No, your
can you
voice
hear me
is
now?
Breaking up. Yes, I hear you now.
Yeah. Okay. As we're going through the story, and now Dorothy has Toto, as always. She has the Scarecrow. She has the Tin Man. And she comes across the lion. And the phrase here is that when I read it, I broke it.
All right, now, Lisa, you're breaking up. I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
No, you're breaking up.
Okay, hold on just a moment. I'm not sure. It's a landline, so it shouldn't. How's this?
Yeah, that's better now. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Closer to the reception.
Just ask the question, and if I'll try to figure out what you're saying, and then I'll respond.
Okay. So as we have the lion on the path, you have a phrase in the book that made me crack up. It was his blowhard bravado, and I do believe I have used that phrase once or twice in my lifetime explaining a male ego. However, let's talk about the male's blowhard bravado, where he was really very insecure, but he was showing something that was not really where he was coming from, but what he felt he needed to exude. Let's talk about how that really can be a source of inauthentic being, and then how he actually came into his being by just kind of being slapped across the face by Dorothy.
Okay, I really didn't hear your question because of the breaking up, but I will just presume what you were saying. He begins in bravado because of fear. How many people do you know who are there blowing off steam and being angry, you know, and acting angry because they just, they're putting up a wall, a shell, because they really have not had a chance to either be acknowledged for the depth of who they are, to be seen for their gentleness. I'll give you an example. I have found very often that people who have a lot of anger in them, actually, in terms of the positive quality, it is as if they have the chance to be a poet of their own emotions, as if they can hold an artist's palette, you know, with its many, many, many colors. And the different colors are different shades of emotion, from gentle to, and tender to loving to strong to roaring to quiet. I mean, that. But often in our society, we are not permitted to explore the incredible poetic and musical range of our emotional selves. We try to do it sometimes by our songs or by our stories, but when I've often found that when you find people who are just blowing off and being bravado, it is because, in part, it's not just that they are, it is the dying of the old form of the masculine. It is much more interesting. It's that they need access to the complexity, the spectrum of the multicolored richness of their emotional life.
That's beautiful. Now, how do they find that?
Well, one of the ways is to pay attention. You know, when they find themselves in other kinds of emotional states, not anger, but tenderness, but lovingness, but deep appreciation or gratitude, to really rest there and explore it instead of just letting it just go by and put on the stockpile of interesting experiences. What you appreciate appreciates. Where you put your attention is where you are going to grow.
And so the aware person who has anger issues and catches themselves in those moments where they're actually expanding more of the compassion and the love and the joy, will they then start to catch themselves from being angry and then diminish that anger within them?
What they will do is replace it.
Okay.
They will replace one thing with the other. That's the beauty of our, you know, of our nervous systems and our moods and our emotional systems, that we have really a great deal of orchestral control. It's just that we don't do it. You know, we are given in our body mind a Stradivarius, and we come to play it like a plastic fiddle. But mm-hmm. to play the Stradivarius of our mind, our body, of our emotions, is to enter into an inscape and landscape of human possibilities that is so gorgeous that one has no other choice but to continue to explore this phenomenal instrument that we've been given.
And by exploring our phenomenal instrument of our being, part of that would be kind of really being real with ourselves on where our passions lie and where our desires lie, would you say?
Well, yes, but whose passions? Are they your passions, or are they what society thinks your passions should be?
No,
are they
it would
your
definitely
desires?
Be the person's passions, the
yes,
individual.
But I'm saying that's the kind of thing in asking. And also finding, you know, I was a close friend of Joseph Campbell, who was really one of the happiest people I ever knew, you know, the great mythologist,
right.
And who gave the famous phrase, follow your bliss. Because if you follow your bliss, it's going to take you to all kinds of interesting adventures and places, and you'll stop boring God, you know.
So, phenomenal man.
Yeah, he was. But he was enormously happy because he was given to accepting and delighting in the sunshine, in a passage of music, in nature, in, you know, the smell of a good dinner. I mean, he really was present to
right.
life. And when you come present to life, life becomes present to you. And even better, it starts giving you more and more presence in the forms of coincidences, synchronicities, and the sheer effulgent, as my Sicilian grandmother said, abbondanza of life.
And that's also part of that chapter that we were talking about earlier about becoming more aware of all of your senses and becoming more in tune to all of
very
those
much so.
Nature and natural essences that we have around us all the time.
Exactly.
Now, we move into a lot of neuro-linguistic programming. You talk about a lot of neurology, let's talk about neuroplasticity and what that is and how. Neuroplasticity?
Plasticity, yes.
Because you talked about how we can engage in self-directed neuroplasticity. How can we do that?
Now, you've mentioned that a number of times. So what I would like to know is, what is it about neuroplasticity that has really gotten to you?
What I really appreciate is the ability to recreate our thoughts and also to move through our blocks and our fears with that. And so we had talked about before, we had talked about how the scarecrow was moving along and recognized his own essence, and then he went into a heap. You know, he went into the heap, and then he jumped to his feet and started to dance and became animated and all those those aspects. But this piece is more of, and that we were talking about, a contemplative neuroscience. Is that the same aspect of neuroplasticity, or is that a different aspect of it?
Oh, it's many aspects of it. You know, the brain, we know, as I say in the book, is not hardwired. It is not a complex machine that cannot change. It has, as I say, it has tremendous capacities for reorganizing and regrowing itself. So, for example, this is what I love. You know, if one part fails, then another part that seemingly has nothing particular to do with that function takes over. So where there's a death of brain cells, there's also the rebirth of new ones. And brain circuits can recircuit themselves. We can recircuit ourselves. So as my good old friend Bruce Lipton is showing, thinking, learning, acting, intending, meditating, enjoying experiences can activate the very genetic structure of our bodies as well, and thus with our brains, so that we literally can shape not only our brain anatomy and behavior, but we can grow new capacities and even, I believe, a newly evolved human version of ourselves. And so my life's work has been in showing people how to really grow this evolved version of themselves, what I call the possible human. And as you develop the possible human, my friend, you really do develop the possible society as well.
Right, and that's, you know, it fascinates me because there is so much new research being done upon the brain with Alzheimer's and the increase of Alzheimer's. And so I am really fascinated by the fact that we can take control more of our being than what we were first led to believe by science. And so the fact that we have the ability to regrow new aspects of our brain, if one becomes a little atrophied, that aspect to me is fascinating because it gives me hope for a whole generation of people that may have to deal with an aspect within their family or themselves with Alzheimer's, because to me that is the next, you know, aspect of health that we need to really focus upon.
Yeah, I believe that a lot of what we think of as Alzheimer's will be disappearing as we extend our natural age range. I mean, you know, the human being is the only mammal that does not live 10 to 12 times the age of puberty. I mean, your dog lives to be 12, 14, 15. Your cat sometimes lives even longer, you know. But and the point of it is that we should have 100 good years. So that is part of it. But we can't have 100 good years with Alzheimer's. Now, having said that, let me introduce something else.
Okay.
At one point in my life, due to a series of very interesting circumstances, I spent a good deal, part of several years, working in nursing homes, not for money, but just because I was there seemingly just to be there present for people who had dementia or Alzheimer's, quite elderly people.
Okay.
And I discovered something quite wonderful, that if I approached them in a conversational type of thing, nothing much happened. But if I began to sing and dance with them, a great deal happened. So I learned about 100 songs. What year was this? This was 96, 97, 98. And I learned a lot of songs. And I would deal with an old gentleman who had been born at that time in 1910. And I would take his hands and I would sing to him something that I thought he would have heard as a baby. Hush-a-bye, don't you cry. Go to sleepy little baby. When you wake, you will have all the pretty little horses. And then I might go to a song he could have heard in 1913. Every little movement has, every little movement, every little moment has a movement all its own, every little gesture has a da-da-da-da-da, you know, 1918. I wish I could shimmy like my sister Kate, but all the way up. Charleston,
Jean,
Charleston,
you're an amazing woman.
Anyway, I would sing and I would dance and we would get up at night. By the 1930s, they were really jiving, you know.
Build a ring
for me and my girl. I can't give you anything but love, baby, you know.
And they would sing and dance. Huh?
And then I would sing to them, where have you been? And what have you been doing? And they would sing back, not everyone, but quite a few, and tell me about these tremendous experiences that they were having, you know, these wonderful relationships and great adventures and tremendous landscapes they were galloping across. And occasionally, one or more would become lucid. It was very few, and say that when they were as others were, or the way they used to be, everything was very cloudy and confused. But when they were in their dance and their song and their inner life, it was a very great world. It was as if they had entered into a quantum universe, is the only way I could put it.
Wow. Wow. So it was almost as if in those moments, life took on a whole different flavor and spice for them. It was no longer just like robotic. It was.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
Wow. That's a great story. That's a great story. Oh, Jean, this is
wonderful.
And
I taught a lot of nurses. I taught a lot of nurses to do that. Yeah. Doctors, they said,
it's
possible the brain is, it has collapsed, you know, so they weren't open. But the nurses were.
Oh, good. Good. You know, there's a lot of nurses that I'm finding in the health profession that are much more open to alternative ways of working with their patients.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they know
that. Well, they're
there
with their patients. They see them. They're there. They're hands-on. I mean, they're with them. The doctor just comes through. This is not to put down doctors. And you have many doctors who are brilliant exceptions, you know,
right,
and who are there fully. But by and large, it is the nurses who pay the attention to the fullness of the other.
And it's wonderful that they're listening to alternative ways of helping their patients like this, because that's the compassion. That's the compassionate way that they're coming through. Now, we're going to move towards the end of the story here, and as we're moving towards the end, where we move into Dorothy's dark night of the soul, let's talk a little bit about how much power we can all harness from all of us have some time in our lifetime. There has been a moment or a tragedy or an instance where we just feel hopeless and helpless, and there's this loss and this feeling of devastation, and that's what Dorothy experienced when she was in the tower from the witch was had her held up. And
yes,
let's talk about her inspiration and her courageousness that came out of that dark night of the soul.
Well, what is it about what I wrote that particularly appealed to you? Because I did write a lot of things.
I loved the piece where, well, as we were talking about the dark night of the soul, I loved the piece where when she came to and Glinda showed up again, and she said, I think I'm paraphrasing here, but Glenda, she said, Glenda, I want to go home to Kansas, and she says, I need your help, and Glenda says, you don't need my help any longer. You've always had the power to go back to Kansas. And she opened her eyes, and she was in the bed, and all her loved ones were around her, and she felt all the love, and she felt, and she had gone through this big, wonderful, incredible journey with the flying monkeys and everything through all of Yellow Brick Road. And here she ends up in the end of the story where she didn't even leave her bed. And she went through all that growth and all that expansion and all that adventure and all that awareness by staying exactly where she was. So for me, the moral is you're exactly where you need to be to learn.
Well, remember, she said, and I realized it was all in my own backyard.
Yes.
For her own backyard, read the 1939 version of The Collective Unconscious of the Human Soul, so that she could tap into this and that we all contain these great adventures within us. However, to be truthful to the story, the actual story itself, that Frank Baum wrote in The Wizard of Oz, it was a real event. So I would say somewhere between the two is true. Many of us have 5 to 10 to 100 times the amount of sheer experience compared to our ancestor of 150 years ago. And not only the sheer outward experience, but also then are being, ignited, evoked, pushed to the extremes of our interior experience in ways that few in history ever have been, at least not democratically across millions of people. And so it's these two. It both lies within, but we're also in a time of opportunity, education, challenge, relationships that were never there before in human history to the great masses of people. So both stories are true. The great-granddaughter of Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz, got in touch with me not very long ago and told me something that was so amazing. The whole story just downloaded itself into his mind. It was all there, all at once.
Wow.
In the same way that J.R. Rowling received the whole Harry Potter story.
Right.
Boom, just in a few seconds while she was on the train to Manchester. So in a sense, this is a story that has been cooked in the cauldrons of the deep collective human mind that arises at this time, because we are like Dorothy. We are living in an outmoded situation. We are in a state of colossal yearning for we know not what. We feel the lure of becoming. We know that we have to expand not just our musculature and our diet. I mean, that's where a lot of people have put it, but our inward senses, the sheer gorgeous muchness of our personalities, and, of course, the ability to live in a time in which fusions of cultures and consciousness are happening as we move slowly but surely to a world civilization with high individuation of culture. We have to meet our entelechy, our higher guidance self, that which is evoking and provoking us to new ways of being and doing. And, of course, we have to take action. Regrow our minds, knowing that we can do it at any age. Open our hearts. Take the great stories of our life and risk and really do something. Enact our purposes at a higher level. All of this is true. The wizard is us.
The wizard is us. And we are here for a great journey. This has been a wonderful book to read. I highly recommend it. I'm going to buy a few copies for some loved ones of mine, because this is just, it gives you a different perspective at looking at just about everything. it really does. The only thing you didn't cover, and I really wanted to know, was what was the little people's purpose?
Well, the little people recognize her. She's recognized. She lands, and they said, "Are you a goddess? You know, who are you? You're wonderful." They see her in her fullness. They help her get on the road. In the book, they are just, she's really 6 or 7 years old in the book, or 8 years old maybe. So they're all the same size. Judy Garland was 16 at the time, so they have to, change that around a little bit. But but they see her, they acknowledge, "Hi ho, the witch is dead." She has already announced the ending of that which has been tormenting them, and she is recognized for her greatness right in the beginning.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure everybody can get a hold of you. So you have jeanhouston.com as your website. They can get a hold of you for all your workshops and your teleseminars and all the work that you have going on all the time. I don't know how you sleep with everything you've got going on. I really don't.
Well, not too much these days. That's true.
Really? I imagine. But this has been such a wonderful, wonderful treat for me. I've really enjoyed talking to you and just hearing your wisdom and your beautiful perspective on everything we've talked about today, and it's just been a wonderful delight for me. Is there anything you'd like to offer, add, direct our audience to you? The floor is yours.
Well, I think to know that these are the times and we are the people. I mean, we have won the ultimate Olympics, haven't we? I mean, of all those millions of sperm just traveling and swimming like that, meeting that particular egg. You're it. You're the one who won. You won. My goodness, what an outlandish thing. I mean, it's truly like a billion-to-one chance that you actually came into life and formed. And deeply appreciated. You came in coded with so much, with so many talents and joys. Find a group to explore these things. Use my books, use other people's books, whatever. That isn't a psychotherapeutic group. A psychotherapeutic group is very useful, but it's for something else. This is a form a growth group, a teaching learning community, to really work together, to play together, to explore the new ways of being that are yearning at the threshold of your mind and heart to manifest so that you become like Dorothy, one who traverses essentially the road of spiritual pollen and realizes that you have, every one of you in your own unique way, have a splendid mind, a glorious heart, and the courage to do, to be, to act, to become.
Amen. That's beautiful. You're very poetic. You are truly a philosopher. And Jean, God bless you. Thank you for all the work that you have done for all of us, for so many people and countries. I mean, you are just a phenomenal life spring of energy. And I have to say this because I think that this is one of the best quotes I've ever heard. And it came from Buckminster Fuller, and he gave a comment about you, and he said, Jean Houston's mind should be considered a national treasure. And I think that is just a great quote.
Well, there are many, many treasures out there, and the wizard is us. They all lie within us. Thank you very much, Lisa. It's been
thank you very
great
much,
pleasure
Jean.
Talking with you.
It's been a great pleasure for me. God bless you. God bless all of your work that you're doing, and have a wonderful week. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.